Meeting come to order, please. Representative Wilkin, will you approve the minutes for March 2nd, please? Would you make a motion?
Yep, I'll make the motion. Read them thoroughly.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes approved. And also on March 3rd, Representative Huntley, you have a motion for the minutes for March 3rd.
Move their approval.
Thank you. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes approved. First bill on the calendar is House File 3132, Representative Bradley.
House File 3132 be recommended pass, and at this point, refer to the General Register, and then I'll leave it to the committee after we get done if there's a feeling that this could be consent calendar material. But in the meantime, to the General Register.
Very good. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you may see on the bill, there's joint authorship. Representative Huntley is an author as well on this. I think this is a relatively simple adjustment of turning a requirement into an option. What seemed like a good idea in 2004 to require international medical graduates, which if you understand our shortage in some of these fields, that we're trying to allow a pathway for being able to be verified to practice in Minnesota and the United States, was to use what's called the Federal Credentials Verification System. Subsequent to that, the actual implementation, and I won't say much more because I'll allow Mr. Yossi to explain further, let's just say in simple, it didn't work as good as it was intended to. It's cost a lot of money, and I believe that the board is fine with changing. So if you notice, it's just a couple of changes, changing must to may, and to make this optional. And, Mr. Chair, with the agreement of the committee, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Yossi to explain further.
Mr. Yossi, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Yossi. I represent Mayo Clinic and Mayo Health System. Today I'm here representing Mayo Clinic specifically on this bill. I think as just a little background, as most of you know, physicians who want to practice in Minnesota must apply to the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice and to present their credentials. And those credentials must be verified. As Representative Bradley said, in 2004, the law was amended to require that international medical graduates' credentials must be verified with the Federation Credentials Verification Service of the U.S. Federation of State Medical Boards. It was a good idea, but after a year, it has been a disaster, primarily because I think there's been too much demand, and the national group has not been able to meet that demand. For whatever reason, the process has been fraught with extreme delays, mistakes, inconsistent responses to questions and issues, and has, as referenced, has been very expensive. It is probably unique to Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota in this case. As Representative Bradley said, the only change is to allow us to, our potential Minnesota employees, to use the service if possible, but also to go directly to the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice, if that makes more sense, which at this point it does.
Okay. Alright.
So we're recommending this bill.
Very good. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none. Anything further, Mr. Chairman?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just return to the question of the motion. This, I think, would be material for consent calendar if the committee has a consensus on that. I would ask the committee's...
Any discussion on that? Representative Huntley.
And Mr. Chair, I would certainly support this going to the consent calendar. It has been a large problem for the Mayo Clinic and some other... people that are hiring physicians, and I don't think there's any opposition that I know of.
Very good. Any further discussion on that?
I'm sure that I would alter my motions. The bill, House File 3132, be recommended to pass and refer to the consent calendar.
Everybody understand the motion for us. And so, everybody in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Bradley. Pardon me? Morning, Representative Aber. I hope your bill is as easy as the last.
Well, it could be, Mr. Chair. Maybe the same method of motions might be in order. This is about as controversial and maybe it's vanilla morning here. At least we could get off to a kumbaya start here. This has to do with, I won't give you too much of the content. I'll let my witness talk to you about it, but it has to do with some drafting errors and allowing some foreign licensure exceptions to some of the rules that they have. And so I'll just let my witness, Mr. Lee, share.
Very good, sir. If you would identify yourself, you're ready, and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Leach. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. The proposal that we have before you now will correct past drafting errors to the Minnesota Medical Practice Act. The board previously, in years past, amended the licensure portion of the Medical Practice Act to require applicants who had not taken a licensure examination within the past 10 years or were board certified by their specialty board to take a specs examination. This is a special purpose examination that's given by the Federation of State Medical Boards that was just mentioned in the last testimony. Unfortunately, at the time we drafted that legislation, we did not apply it to our two pathways for licensure. We have an entry pathway through licensure through examination and a pathway through reciprocity or endorsement. The requirement that the individual take the specs exam was only applied to those individuals who are applying by endorsement, that is, individuals who are currently licensed in another state. Those individuals who are applying for initial licensure through examination but had not taken the exam within the past 10 years, it was not a requirement for them, basically creating an inequity in the entry pathways. So this legislation is simply trying to correct that and make it applicable to any individual who has not taken a licensure exam in the past 10 years and who is not specialty board certified.
Very good. Anything further, Representative Aver? Perhaps you should make a motion on this. We haven't done that yet.
And it's the pleasure of the committee. It certainly would go to the floor, but if it could go to the consent calendar, it might be the same caliber of the previous bill that the committee would desire.
Well, let's see if there are any questions first. Any questions for the author or witness on this bill? Seeing none, why don't you try your motion?
Let's see how the consent calendar motion goes, Mr. Chair. If we could move that to go to the consent calendar. That'd be my motion.
Representative Abler moves that House File 2745 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent agenda. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman, I think you should notify the press that, yes, we can all get along.
Very good. All right. Any more questions to the motion for us? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
As opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Yes. All right.
Next bill on the agenda, House File 3130. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the appropriate motion at this point, because I am expecting that there might be a fiscal note, so I think we're going to, in the end, need to lay it over for possible inclusion or certainly to determine the fiscal note. So, Mr. Chair, I think my recommendation would be that we recommend a pass based on policy, but that we hold the bill over for inclusion or for analysis of the fiscal note.
Very good. Representative Bradley, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, if you recall, we had a hearing a few weeks ago in which we brought in many of the services for persons with developmental disability to understand the many programs and to understand sort of where we are policy-wise and to understand some of the funding streams. And if you recall, actually, this committee last time... Oh, I do have a fiscal note. Okay, well, that... Well, we can discuss that in a moment. I'll explain the policy and let us run through. I guess what I missed was that we do, in fact, have a preliminary fiscal note. And there'll be a question about whether $30,000 is a word for it, at least negligible amount, but we'll come back to that. So let me come back a little bit to the policy. This committee actually passed a proposal to study this issue last time around. We suggested that it was really time to look again at where we are in terms of our state policies for ICFMRs. As a matter of fact, included in this policy area, we also recommended to reduce the county share, which had been previously placed at 20%. We had suggested actually reducing it to 5%, and if you recall, subsequent to the conference committee last year, we did reduce it to 10%. So I think that shows some intent on the part of this committee of our desire to sort of reevaluate where we are. I personally feel like the pressure to downsize ICFMRs, which I think had a good intent in its beginning, has reached a point where I think the future is questionable. The ones that I visit anyway, I think if you look at the medical fragility of the people who are there, the economies of scale, the acceptance of families, I think all the ingredients, it seems to me, are right for saying that those alternatives have a good place. And so we, I think, historically have, as a committee, felt that. Given the base that we've built, I think this bill is a little bit different. What this now instructs the department to do is to sort of come back with a set of proposals from a policy point of view on ICFMR. So that's it's as simple as that. And Bruce Nelson, who would probably be normally with us, I'm told, is not well today, so a very able replacement than Mr. Anderson. So I'd like to turn it over to him for comment.
Thank you, Representative Vadley. Mr. Anderson, identify yourself with the tape and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Frank Anderson. I'm the Deputy Director of ARM. I've had the pleasure of representing ARM for about the past 3 years. Prior to that, was a private provider providing services to people with developmental disabilities in Minnesota for approximately 14 years. I think what we're trying to do with this bill is repeat a success, which is something we don't get an opportunity to do enough, I don't think. And prior to 2000, representatives of the provider industry, other stakeholders, and the Department of Human Services was successful in replacing the old funding system for ICFMRs, what was referred to as Rule 53, with a new system that was simpler, and it allowed for accommodations for critical needs that arose of individuals in ICFMRs, and also allowed for some accommodation of long-term changes to people residing in ICFMRs so that increasing needs could be paid for. Unfortunately, after that point, Minnesota, as everybody here certainly knows, had a tough budget time, and a number of the accommodations that allowed that system to operate fell apart over the following 3 years. And we did bring a handout that is 2 pages that starts with the red ink at the top. I understand I can be appreciated by being brief, so I'm going to go for the appreciation. And I won't go through all this, but what this does is outline what those items were that there was consensus around and how they have dissolved over the subsequent 3 to 4 years. Providers gave up a number of concessions, including $1.75 million, in order to implement these changes, which then went away. And what we're suggesting at this point is not to rehash that or to go backwards, but to bring that group together again, look at the ICFMR system, decide if Minnesota should have an ICFMR system, if so, what that system should be, and how we best support it. And although we're talking about policy and systems issues, I would like to just remind all of us that the implications for this is very real for the individuals who currently live in ICFMRs. Whether we have a plan that takes care of them in a thoughtful and respectful manner, or whether we allow willy-nilly factors to force programs to close, is up to us, and it does have a real effect on real people. And we're seeking your support in coming together and accomplishing that.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Representative Bradley, have anything to add?
No, I do think it would be fair, though, to offer. I don't know if there's anybody else here that may wish to testify, but I think an offer would be in order.
Very good. Anybody wish to testify on the bill before us, House File 3032, please come forward. Nope, excuse me. That's House File 3130. Anybody wish to testify upon that bill? Seeing no one.
Even though the amount on the fiscal note is relatively small, I think, though, it would be wise for me to have an opportunity to visit, and it is a preliminary fiscal note at that, that I would stay with the motion as I made it, and that that we would be, in a sense, approving the policy, but that we would hold it over for possible consideration.
Okay, very good. Representative Bradley renews his motion that the bill 3130 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Policy Finance Omnibus Bill. Very good. Thank you. Next bill on the agenda, House File 3032, Representative Emmer.
Do we have an amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Chair. As Representative Emmer is approaching the testifier's table, I just want to explain to members, this morning it came to my attention that there was some confusion over drafting originally, and that there was going to be a delete all, and I got a little nervous because I had intended for today to be relatively straightforward bills. However, I think that with due diligence on the part of the author and other people involved, that's been reviewed, I think, with the minority caucus members as well. I talked to Ripson Huntley, who suggested that he agreed it was fine for us to proceed, but I just wanted to keep the integrity of what we promised, and that was certainly not my intention. But I think that's been done with due diligence to the author, and I think we're prepared to proceed with the bill today.
Very good. Representative Emmer,
thank you, committee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first order of business, I would like to offer the or move the DE-1 amendment. And just as a little background, the DE-1 amendment.
Emmer, just a moment. Just make sure everybody has the DE-1 amendment in front of them. And first, you'd like to have you move the bill. If you would, please.
Oh. So moved, sir.
Representative Emmer moves that House File 3032 be recommended to pass and
moved to the general register.
Be placed on the general register. And he further moves the DE-1 amendment.
Correct.
Proceed, Representative Emmer.
Does everybody have the DE-1 amendment? Mm-hmm. First off, as background for the committee, I also offered or introduced House File 3030, which is actually the bill that I would like to be here today presenting. That was a bill that said quite simply that a pharmacist in this state can refuse to dispense a drug based on moral, ethical, religious beliefs grounds. That, however, is not the bill that we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about House File 3232 and specifically as I'm moving to amend it with a DE-1 amendment, which is a little complicated. I'll explain why Representative Bradley was raised this issue before starting. First, the original bill that I offered, 3030, has been changed. I agreed to carry 3032 because it's a compromise. This is a compromise by the folks that actually dispense these drugs. They would like to see something get passed this year, if at all possible. My understanding, and I have some folks here that will explain the bill to you, and part of the problems that they see, one of the necessity for the bill, is that there are complaints, as I understand it, pending or that will be presented in the event that pharmacists choose to exercise their rights. This is a balancing of the liberty of the pharmacist versus the right and necessity of the patient to get their legally prescribed medications. So why the DE-1 amendment that's in front of you? Because when this bill was originally brought to me, the agreement between the folks that are pushing this legislation and the Pharmacists Association was that they would agree to taking language similar to that which has been passed in the state of California. That language is before you as the DE-1 amendment. After that agreement was made, a senator took the bill as it was drafted following the California language and redrafted it, or had it redrafted with different language that was not language agreed to by all of the parties involved. That language actually got filed as House File 3032. Of course, after it got filed, there was a lot of, I won't use the word tension, but there was a lot of discussion about what had happened and why they didn't get the language that they had all agreed on. That language is the Delete All Amendment number one that's in front of you, and that's why I'm moving it today, because that is the language that has been agreed to by all of the interested parties. With that, I would ask you to support the DE-1 amendment. If you have any questions on that, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any discussion on the DE-1 amendment, Representative Goodman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ammer, I'm just wondering if you proceed with the DE-1 amendment, if that, and we agreed on language in there, if that's the way you're going to continue it through the process, or are you going to be thinking of substituting the original bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin.
Representative Ammer.
In response, I will keep my word. I told you as we started this morning that if I had my preference, I would prefer the original language that I submitted as House File 3030. But because I'm not a pharmacist and I'm carrying this bill on their behalf, this is their agreement, and I'll carry it as they have agreed, as all the interested parties have agreed, I'll carry it in this form.
Thank you.
For the questions, Representative Pepper.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if someone could explain what a legend drug and device, if you could explain those two definitions.
Representative Emmer.
That's going to be more appropriate for the folks that are going to testify in support of the bill.
All right.
If you'd like to get into that now, Mr. Chair, we could do that. Otherwise, I would like to get the DE-1 amendment before the committee as the bill, and then we'll have folks explain the language to you and then answer those questions.
I think that's fair, Rod. Any further questions on the DE-1 amendment so the author can get the bill in the shape he wishes it to be? Seeing no other questions, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
All right.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the bill now before you is House File 3032. I've already explained to you how it came to be in my hands, and I'm presenting it to you as a balance, a compromise between the liberty of the individual pharmacist versus the right of the patient to obtain his or her legally prescribed medications. I have with me today Michael Barrett, who is a pharmacist from Long Prairie, Minnesota, who's going to talk to you a little bit about the need, his belief in the need for this legislation. And then we also have the president-elect from the Pharmacists Association, who will explain the bill to you. So with that, Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Barrett, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Barrett. I'm a pharmacist at Long Prairie Memorial Hospital and Home in Long Prairie, Minnesota, the hometown of Representative Trumba. In regards to the question about the original bill, I wrote that bill, and Representative Emmer would bring it forward, and I have since told him to drop that bill and go forward with the language you have here in the amendment. Okay. The reason for that is that from the time of the initial bill, I had been working with representatives from the Pharmacy Association, Minnesota Pharmacists Association, and we have come up with compromise language, because one thing that wasn't addressed in the original bill as I wrote it was the need for us to accomplish our professional responsibility to see to it that patients do get their medications in a timely manner. And I think that bill addresses this. If you will look at the bill, I'm not going to go into great detail on the bill because I believe Todd Sorensen will do that later. It basically describes in Subdivision 1 the intent. It's the intent to find a mechanism for pharmacists who hold moral, ethical, or religious objections to refuse to dispense that drug. But it also puts a requirement on them that they fulfill their professional duty and assist the patient in some manner to access the drugs that are needed. And it goes into prohibitions. It says we shall not dispense refused to dispense Legend drugs. And getting back to the other question, Legend requires a prescription. Non-Legend is like your over-the-counter pills. So, basically, it says, notwithstanding, we can refuse to dispense on three conditions. Okay, is based first on our clinical training, so that we don't give drugs that are detrimental to the patient. For example, if you were to pass a law that would force pharmacists to dispense all legal medications, that would mean we could not refuse to dispense Viagra for known sex offenders or high doses of OxyContin for known drug abusers. Okay, we need the ability to use our professional judgment. Secondly, because pharmacies are a business, many times they don't stock all available Legend drugs or devices. In this case, it provides a clear pathway for the pharmacist to offer three different options to the patient. They can secure the drug or device from another pharmacy and dispense it at a later time. They can have it called into another pharmacy to have that ready when the patient gets there, or they can give the prescription back to the patient with arrangements that the patient knows whether they can secure that. These two are pretty straightforward and not so controversial, I think. The controversial part comes in number three. This is what's called the pharmacist conscience clause. This will allow us to refuse to dispense a medication based on ethical, moral, or religious grounds. But it doesn't let us just stop there. If you will read further into it, you will see that it requires us to have a protocol in place that allows the patient to either know where to get it or have other means of the patient getting that drug. It also requires the pharmacist to put in writing the classes of drugs that they're objecting to. So what we've done, we've satisfied in this amendment the pharmacist's conscience, and we've also satisfied the needs of the patient who need to get the medication in a timely manner. And it also satisfies the needs of the employer so that it does not put an undue hardship on the employer. I think this is fair and reasonable. For me, besides my education, my morals and ethics are the most important assets I bring to my job. You know, but today I find these guiding principles under direct attack from those who would legislate that would become second-class professionals and be forced by law to dispense medications that we know can be sometimes harmful to patients. I feel a pharmacist should be entitled to the same protections as a physician or nurse. We are men and women of medicine, and at this point we don't require physicians or nurses to perform abortions in Minnesota. Why should we require pharmacists to participate in the same thing? If pharmacists are legally forced to dispense all legal prescriptions, many will simply leave the profession, or some may never enter it. We will end up with a profession that's devoid of people of faith, people of morals, and people of ethics. And I don't think that's such a good road to go down. The other issue is that pharmacies are ultimately also a business. If a business chooses not to stock a product that somebody wants, they will go elsewhere, and the businessman takes that risk. But yet, can we at the same time think of legislating that all Muslim and Jewish butchers must carry pork? I don't think this is a place for government to get into. The values expressed by health professionals like myself, I think, underscore the decent values of the people of Minnesota. While being liberal on some issues, Minnesota is definitely pro-life. We hold personal responsibility in high regard and overwhelmingly choose the culture of life over the culture of death. And I think, personally, we need more pharmacists of conscience, not fewer. Thank you.
Sir, thank you for your testimony. Any questions so far? Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Barrett, I'm interested in some of your comparisons with nurses and doctors and with pharmacists. And first, let me say that, you know, my father believed that, bless his soul, that he should have vets that diagnose him, because animals don't have to tell you what's wrong, and that he should have pharmacists prescribe for him because they know a lot more about medications than doctors often do. But I am concerned about religious, moral, ethical grounds, how strong that's stated. That's a lot of reasons to not dispense, and I think a doctor would be found with malpractice if he didn't perform a life-saving or a function in his job that would help the patient get, you know, to have better health. So when you're using all those criteria, that's a concern to me, as well as reasonable effort. I don't know what reasonable effort means, so I'd like to ask what you think reasonable effort means in this case of this amendment.
Mr. Barrett.
Yes, thank you. You refer to physicians being required to perform life-saving measures, okay, as part of their Hippocratic oath, because that is a true medical emergency. What we're talking about here is RU-486 and the morning after pill Plan B. And these, if you'll read the package insert, they can be given up to 72 hours after intercourse. Studies have shown that these are effective up to 1 week afterwards. So this does not classify it as a medical emergency. We need to understand that, okay? The label of emergency contraceptive, it misleads the people to thinking you need it immediately, and it masks other truths about the drug. What happens here is that, getting back to the point where doctors and nurses you mentioned first, there's statutory law in Minnesota that says health professionals may not be forced to participate in an abortion. We have also have statutory definition that classifies abortion as the termination of a pregnancy. The problem is there is no statutory definition of when a pregnancy starts. And this gets into the part of the morals. Some people like myself consider life beginning at conception. Other people consider it starting at implantation. What happens is the reason the Board of Pharmacy has, I know of at least one or two complaints that they can't act on because we don't have a definition of a pregnancy. And they say we need to address this legislatively to give pharmacists the ability that doctors and nurses have now, because doctors and nurses perform or would participate in actual abortions, where pharmacists have to do dispense into this gray area between conception and implantation. So I think that's also very important.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garrett, but the two cases in Minnesota that I'm aware of where pharmacists wouldn't dispense, it was birth control pills, it wasn't morning after pills or whatever. And even with the morning after pill, that doesn't work if the woman's already conceived. It only works if you take the pill within 72 hours because a pregnancy doesn't happen for at least 72 hours after intercourse. So it doesn't happen where the egg and the sperm unite for at least that long. And I'm sure a lot of people aren't aware of that, or they choose to not to deal with that. But in either case, a pharmacist doesn't know whether or not the woman has been a victim, or the girl, of incest or rape or something like that. Also, he doesn't know the status of the woman's need for birth control pills and so forth. So I think anything that allows them to discriminate based on gender and based on issues they don't even know might exist with that patient when the doctor has ordered that prescription is really unfair to one sex, and so I have a lot of problems with still some of the language in here that is too broad. And I would just say that an abortion, as you used as an example, that doctors have a right not to participate in an abortion, is fair and so forth. This is not about an abortion. This is about preventing an abortion. So this is about taking birth control and possibly the morning after pill to prevent a pregnancy, and further down to prevent the possibility of an abortion. So it strikes me as strange that there would be pharmacists that would even decide that they didn't want to. What if they decided they didn't believe in antidepressants and a woman had postpartum depression and they decided not to prescribe those? There's a number of things that under that broad category of moral, ethical, or religious grounds that could fit into that for any particular pharmacist. And of course, in areas like yours where there's not a lot of pharmacies, that particularly is a problem for people. And so I would just personally suggest that pharmacists not go into that field if they're going to be not wanting to fill prescriptions that doctors have prescribed. But it is, in my opinion, a discriminatory practice against women.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dean.
Can we get a response from Mr. Barrett on that?
I didn't hear a question, Representative Wilkin.
I'm just curious.
He can respond. I would be happy to hear.
I would like to respond,
response.
If I could, to clarify some points for her.
Thanks.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last thing you spoke to was that, I shouldn't be in the profession if I don't want to do it. You got to understand, I've been a professional for 30 years. And it wasn't until I'd been a professional at least 10 years that we even had RU-46, which is the abortion pill. So it's a matter of now I would have to choose to leave my profession. I took an oath to help save life and not to take it. The thing is, again, some of the fallacies about the morning after pill. The people who support tell you it will only prevent a pregnancy. It will not cause an abortion. Well, I need to remind the people here that if you are a woman who is past the point in your cycle where you have ovulated, the chances are pretty good you have an embryo in your womb. And this embryo has split through cell division several times before it implants. Now, that gets to the basis of the problem. I consider that a pregnancy. You do not. So the thing is that now what people try and tell me is that the woman should have a right to dispense, or the choice to dispense with an embryo, where I as a pharmacist should not have a choice to not dispense a potential abortifacient. So the thing is, we need to understand that all the information out there is not accurate. Getting back to the other point is, you talk about choices. I feel that even in the case of rape and incest, there is another choice available, and adoption immediately comes to mind.
I'm not even going to go there.
Okay. Very good. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Goodwin brings up a couple good points, is that we expect all our medical providers to use ethical judgment when they're treating patients. And I see this as a direct extension of that, but you look at physicians, if you can look beyond abortion, I think we expect all our physicians to make those kinds of judgments. The number one contraindication for plastic surgery, from what I understand, is that the doctor examines the patient and finds that there is some sort of emotional, mental thing that person is going through that says that I can't ethically operate on this person because I believe that's not in the best interest of this patient. That's an ethical choice that plastic surgeon makes, and that's something that we expect them to do, and that's something they should do on a daily basis. And I think that this is a direct extension to pharmacists, that we want them to use good ethical judgment and from everything that they bring into their profession. And so I think that your logic is sound in that, in a direct extension, then you make a good comparison to your colleagues with MDs. As we look to the DE-1 amendment on 111.112, there it says, a violation of this section constitutes unprofessional conduct by the pharmacist and shall subject the pharmacist to disciplinary or administrative action by the Board of Pharmacy. I'm just a little concerned that perhaps I'm kind of walking through the situation of a pharmacist deciding not to prescribe and going through the protocols and procedures for finding other treatment or deferring or referring that particular patient, that this provides enough protection to that pharmacist by harassment by different groups or folks that may want to do that. If a pharmacist were to do this and someone wanted to have an action, would that be action or a letter, or how would that work with the Board of Pharmacy, and how would that pharmacist be protected against harassment by these groups that are out there?
I'm not a member of the Board of Pharmacy, so I really can't speak for them, but it's the understanding in crafting this legislation is that ultimately, as pharmacists, we're charged with doing all we can to provide services for the patient.
okay? And when you look at it, giving a letter in writing to your employer and your employer having a protocol in place whereby the patient can successfully procure the drug somewhere, I don't think puts undue burden on a pharmacist. And I speak that as a pharmacist. If you've got somebody who does it, the board has different choices. They can send letters out. They can do mild disciplinary actions, repeat offenses. They can do more, you know, serious things. But I think as a matter of law, if we're going to pass this bill, we need to have some enforcement measure with it also. And I'm comfortable with it the way it's written.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next on my list, and we do have some more testifiers, so we can move along in the next few minutes. Representative Otremba, I believe, is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barrett, again, going back to abortion and what is an abortion and defining when life begins. Some of us think it's conception. Some of us think it's when it's born, and there's a whole continuum in between. In current law, it talks about unprofessional conduct and conduct in injuring public, and it talks about abortions and non-liability for refusal to perform. And in current law, if it's about abortion, pharmacists are already exempt. And we know, as you have said, that there are many ways to have an abortion, including some of the contraceptive pills. The way they work is the intent is that they work from preventing ovulation, but there are cases, and this is in the medical journal, where it says that the way that the pill is successful is it sloughs off the fertilized egg. So, and I know there are cases around the country where physicians have refused to to write a prescription for what they believe are abortifacients in birth control, and those cases have all been won, quite frankly, by the physician, based on what we know about when life begins. So this bill almost makes it worse, because in current law we already have a mandatory exemption for pharmacists with abortion. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Barrett.
Representative Otremba. If you look at the statute, it says we don't have to participate. It does mention pharmacists specifically, I don't think, does it?
Isn't that the one with the healthcare workers?
The rule does say that.
The rule, right, but it refers to a statute. And the statute says healthcare workers can't be forced to participate in an abortion. Abortion is therefore, as I said before, defined as a termination of a pregnancy. Well, but pregnancy isn't defined, and that's the problem. It doesn't, you know, the thing is that Minnesota Medical Association defines pregnancy as the implantation of an embryo. Okay, but I'm sure Representative Cameron and myself feel that pregnancy begins at the moment of conception. So what happens is that pharmacists are in a unique position because they're not using instruments and anesthetics and different things to terminate a pregnancy. They could be simply dispensing a pill that would cause the same thing. So we need to address this because it's not addressed in current state statutes. And the Pharmacy Board of Minnesota has determined that the current rules and statutory law do not give them direction on whether to discipline or not discipline a pharmacist.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Trump.
I've been working on this bill for 6 years.
Yes.
And I know that it says in there, in rule, pharmacists. And so I don't know where you get the idea that pharmacists aren't included.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Emma,
would it, if you have one handy, I think it would be helpful to Mr. Barrett and to me if we could see the actual language that you're referring to. And then, Mr. Chair, the other thing that I'd just like to make note of is that we do have some other testifiers and some have limited schedules.
Very good. We do have
Representative Sanderson, could we wait until perhaps we have another testifier, and or would you like to direct your question specifically to Mr. Barrett?
Mr. Chair, either way.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and move on, take another testifier here, and then you'll be next on the question list. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll remain for questions to follow later if need be.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Emmer,
this is President-elect Todd Sorensen from the Minnesota Pharmacists Association.
Very good. Mr. Sorensen, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Dr. Todd Sorensen. I'm the President-elect of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, and I'm an associate professor at the College of Pharmacy at the University of Minnesota. I've been a pharmacist for 12 years, and I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you to present the views of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association on House File 3032 as amended. House File 3032 as amended addresses four possible instances in which a pharmacist may refuse to dispense a medication. The first provision protects pharmacists' ability to refuse based on clinical judgment. The second provision allows refusal to dispense if the drug is not in stock in the pharmacy, but has options for procedures to ensure patient access. The third provision protects pharmacists' refusal based on religious, ethical, and moral beliefs and ensures patient access to care. And the fourth provision allows pharmacists to refuse to dispense if they do not receive payment for the drug or device pursuant to a prescription order. I'll describe these provisions and their importance to pharmacists. According to Minnesota Rule 6800-3110, a pharmacist has a duty to refuse to fill a prescription if, in the pharmacist's professional judgment, filling it as written will cause unnecessary harm to a patient. This includes errors in strength of dosage or dosage, possible drug interactions or allergies, or if it seems that the pharmacist's judgment, in the pharmacist's judgment, that the prescription was obtained illegally. The pharmacist's clinical judgment must be protected as a final safety check before the medication is dispensed to a patient, and House File 3032 protects pharmacist's clinical judgment. Decisions about which medications to stock are based on the patient population served, the health plans in which the pharmacy participates, and the prescribing patterns of the physicians and other prescribers in the community. Medications that are widely used in some geographic areas may be used infrequently in others. The language amended into House File 3032 addresses these issues without putting undue hardship on the pharmacy as a business entity. It has three standard options for pharmacists to offer patients for accessing a medication, that is not in stock. As amended, the language is broad enough to accommodate various pharmacies and does not mandate how a business accommodates their specific stocking needs. With more than 10,000 medications on the market today, it is impossible and unnecessary for a pharmacy to carry all medications. This provision in the language protects the pharmacy's independent business decisions, but directs the pharmacy to assist their patients in accessing out-of-stock drugs. Pharmacists want to retain the ability to opt out of providing services to which they personally object, a situation similar to all other health care providers. It is critical that while protecting the ability of pharmacists to step away, patients are not abandoned. This bill ensures that consideration to the impact of these and other moral dilemmas are addressed before a conflict is presented in the workplace. The language requires pharmacists to notify their employer in writing to the drug or class of drugs they refuse to dispense based on religious, ethical, or moral reasons. The employer, or the pharmacy, must then have protocols in place to ensure the patient can access the medication. Requiring establishment of protocols to ensure the patient timely access to a prescribed drug or device allows each employer or pharmacy to establish a protocol that will work for that particular setting. Allowing each pharmacy to develop their individual system enables the process to be seamless, similar to the interaction that occurs with any other prescription. When alternative systems are established proactively, the patient is unaware of the pharmacist's actions, and both the patient's right to care and the pharmacist's need to step away from an activity are accommodated. The last provision is very simple. It states that there is no duty on pharmacists to dispense a drug or prescription order without payment from the patient, a third-party payer, or any co-payment from the patient for the drug or device. It is important to note that recent activity at the state and federal levels and media attention regarding pharmacists refusing to dispense medications due to ethical, religious, or moral reasons has magnified the issue to a degree that does not accurately reflect the scope. Pharmacists refusing to dispense medications is a statistically negligible problem. The vast majority of pharmacists dispense the vast majority of prescriptions without incident to patients. Whether expanding the pharmacist's role in improving medication use, working successfully to implement the Medicare prescription drug benefit, or enacting laws to allow pharmacists to immunize patients, pharmacists are stepping up to the plate to ensure patients have access to medications and know how to make the best use of those medications. Patients trust pharmacists to be drug experts on the healthcare team and to provide them with information to improve their health. As healthcare professionals, pharmacists are tasked with providing care to patients. Occasionally, individual personal beliefs may conflict with a pharmacist's professional responsibility to fill specific prescription orders. Resolving the dilemma of how to make certain a patient has access to appropriate drug therapy as determined by their prescribing practitioner while allowing pharmacists to follow their conscience is complex, but House File 3032, as amended, is a balanced approach that addresses the needs of the patient and the needs of the pharmacist personally and professionally. I'd just like to add that during the discussion prior to this testimony, that a lot of discussion focused on the issue of abortion. This issue for the Pharmacists Association is not about abortion. It is about balancing values and balancing access. And if this bill were to be passed into law and if it's followed as it's written, the issues that are often described will be transparent to patients and patients will have access without incident. So I thank you for the opportunity to provide the pharmacist's perspective on this important issue, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sorensen. Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Mr. Sorensen, I was just curious as to what devices and what drugs are on this list that you have made up. And then the timeliness of, or timely access to another facility or another pharmacy. What are you talking about there when we look at the bill? What's timely, what's near enough if someone at one pharmacy will not fill a prescription?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Sorensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanderson, the first question regarding what medications are on the list, this list doesn't actually exist. This is a decision that is defined by the individual as to what medications might be objectionable in terms of moral and ethical reasons. The discussion is focused on things like oral contraception and Plan B. However, there could be other medications or devices that an individual could object to. So there is no list, and that would be defined at the practice setting by the individual in writing to their employer. And then the employer would be developing the protocols to ensure access. The question about timeliness, that is something that we don't feel can be written into law. It's going to be specific based on communities, based on the practice setting. So I don't know that I have a good answer to that because that will be defined individually. Other than if something is felt that a patient is denied access in a timely manner, I'm sure that that's a position that's going to be brought forward as if it was concerned that it was professional misconduct that resulted to that, and that is accounted for in the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you what I agree with Representative Sanderson on the questions. It leaves a lot of questions wide open. But what if the pharmacist is the employer? What if he owns the pharmacy? Then how does it work?
Mr. Sorensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin. I'm sorry, I can't see the nameplate.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
That is a question that we've discussed internally within the association many times, and it's certainly an issue that's of importance because there are a number of pharmacies in rural areas where there's only one pharmacist and the pharmacist may be the owner. In those instances, we believe that this extends to working within the community and that the backup option is probably the prescriber in that case, and that we feel that if that individual has feels that there's going to be instances in which conscience would be enacted, that they need to work with the prescribers in that community and identify alternative sources if another community is too far away to meet the reasonable access standards. So medications could be dispensed by the physician or the nurse practitioner through provider dispensing.
Mr. Chair, I want to follow up. How do you define reasonable efforts?
I think that goes back to the goes back to the previous question that that's going to largely be defined by the employer to some degree, that it's difficult to provide any sort of geographic distance or time distance because of issues of access and distribution of providers. I don't know that I have an answer to that, except that it's going to have to be balanced with patient definition of that as well. And if patients are feeling that they are not receiving care and appropriate access, then that's going to be brought forward.
Very good. We have Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess, you know, both you, represent Emma or Mr. Sorensen could answer this. I keep thinking to myself, is there really a need for this bill? Because that drug will get dispensed under this bill regardless. And so it's like, this guy won't sell it to me, go down the road, the other guy will give it to you. So is there really a need for this kind of bill here?
Mr. Sorensen. Mr. Chair, Representative Tao, thank you. That's partly what I was alluding to with the statistical instances of this is negligible. However, the possibility of occurring can occur, and proactively addressing the issue so that it does not occur, we think, is the best policy. And by working with an employer, that it's less likely that a patient is going to approach a situation where they are going to feel unaccommodated, and that the employer will be able to address this so everything is transparent to the patient. Does that address your question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tao, I think that answers the question. I think the thing that you maybe need to recall, we've been going for quite a while, is that this is supposed to be a balancing of two competing interests. They can be competing interests. One, the overwhelming interest of the Pharmacists Association and the individual pharmacists to comply with their clinical obligation to dispense, balanced against what they may have a moral, ethical objection to dispensing a specific drug. In order to address the issue and allow the board to be able to deal with these so that people do get access and we honor somebody's moral, ethical, or religious objection, we need this legislation.
We have other testifiers here, and I think maybe we need to move on to that.
Mr. Chairman,
we do have another bill on the agenda.
Could I ask a quick question now by this witness?
Mr. Sorensen specifically?
Mr. Sorensen or Representative Emmer could probably answer it.
All right, please. Thank you.
Okay. Just real quick, on page 2, lines 210 through 212, it talks about the employer shall ensure that there's timely access. But some employers are going to have the same objection that any individual pharmacist might have, and I'm thinking specifically Minnesota's Catholic hospitals. What can be done to change that? Because if we leave the wording in as it's written, those hospitals are going to be put in a real bind because they're ethically cannot participate in providing that drug, whether it's through a referral or otherwise.
Mr. Sorensen? Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, if I could restate the question, make sure that I understand it. It's the issue of certain hospitals having policies in place that would prevent dispensing of medications, and therefore the employer, asking the employer to establish a protocol that goes against potentially the mission or the policies within the organization itself.
Yes, that'd be correct.
I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I guess in that case, an institution has a policy like that, I would probably assume that patients would understand that in choosing that healthcare facility. And if it becomes an issue, as Representative Emmer has mentioned already, this is also an issue that would go to the Board of Pharmacy for resolution.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, I'm going to add to that that this bill does contemplate that. Keep in mind that President Sorensen told us or testified earlier that in the event we have a owner-owned pharmacy, they would establish these protocols and work within the community, and probably it would go back to the hospital or some other source. It doesn't stop there. The idea is that you would have to develop protocols because the compromise, as has been explained to me over and over, and as we've heard today, is to make sure that someone has access to legally prescribed medications while at the same time balancing that against the individual pharmacist's right. In this case, hospital, that institution should have that same right. And again, you'd have to establish protocols to deal with that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I just want to make sure that those hospitals will have an out, that they won't be harassed or their license threatened if they refuse to dispense and, frankly, refuse to refer, because they're not going to want to refer either because they don't want to be an active participant in the act.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Emmer.
Representative Wilkin, if I might, please note that nothing in this bill makes or creates such a requirement. At least based on the language that I've read, again, it requires the employer to establish appropriate protocols to deal with the situation. And perhaps Dr. Sorensen has a different take, but that's my reading and understanding of the bill.
Dr. Sorensen, do you have anything to add?
The only thing I would add is that reminding that one of the issues in the bill is that no institution is required to stock any particular medication, that the decision of stocking medications is left to the employer. So the bill does not require an institution that would not have as a policy the ability to dispense to even stock the medication.
Mr. Chairman, just one more thing, and I'll let it go because I think the author will work with me on it. But it does say the employer shall ensure the patient timely access. That's troublesome because it puts an obligation on that hospital. And I don't think that's what we want to do. There's been bills on this before in this legislature, and it's been introduced on the floor, and I called it the Catholic Hospital Closure Act because they will not do this, and their license could be threatened at that time. So I think we need to clarify that at some point in the process here.
Very good. Members, we do have other testifiers here, and we do want to be fair to everybody. So I'm going to ask that Representative Femba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But on page 1.23, they have to notify the patient and arrange for the drug or device to be delivered to the site or directly to the patient in a timely manner. And so that seems like pretty strong language, too. I think it's something to think about.
Very good. On my agenda, I have next an Aaron Mattson.
Thank you.
Hi. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly. I'm Aaron Mattson, and I'm the president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Organization for Women. And we believe that this bill puts basic medical care in danger. As you know, this bill would allow pharmacists to refuse to fill prescriptions on the basis of personal beliefs. In practice, this means more pharmacists will refuse to fill basic birth control prescriptions here. In practice, it's already happened twice here in Minnesota, basic birth control. It's the duty of pharmacists to fill prescriptions. It's the duty of this committee to rise above unscientific personal beliefs about birth control. Birth control is basic medical care. According to the CDC, 90% of women will use some form of birth control when they're between the ages of 15 and 44. And yet there are pharmacists who refuse to dispense birth control. They say birth control is abortion. When they refuse to fill birth control, they are promoting unintended pregnancy, and in turn, encouraging the very practice they dispensed. Doctors have the right to ensure basic medical care for their patients. Pharmacists who refuse to dispense birth control not only subvert the doctor-patient relationship, they make a mockery of the Hippocratic Oath to
respect the privacy of my patients. While this bill includes a smoke screen provision of what's called reasonable accommodation for pharmacists to transfer prescriptions to other stores, this codifies discrimination against several classes of women in Minnesota law. Women in rural areas may need to travel 30 miles or more to visit other stores. Women with disabilities may not be able to access other stores. Women in poverty may not have the means to travel, whether they don't have a car, resources for additional transportation, or time to take off work to travel to another store. Women with certain medical plans may be able to fill prescriptions at only a fixed number of other stores. Women with time-sensitive birth control prescriptions may not have the time to travel to other stores. Women deserve more than a wild goose chase law. On behalf of the more than 2,300 members of the Minnesota chapter of the National Organization for Women and the 90% of women who will use birth control, I urge you not to pass this bill out of committee. Please honor basic medical care, protect doctor-patient relationships, and reduce the number of women seeking abortion. Thank you.
Thank you for testimony. Any questions for Ms. Mattson? Seeing none, also on my agenda I have Amy Gilbert. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against House File 3032? Members, do you have any further questions of Bill's author or any other testifiers?
I do have one final.
Oh, didn't see it. Representative Goodman.
I do have one final question, Mr. Chair, and Representative Elmer. This bill gets to the floor, gets out of committee, and I already asked you if you assured me that you weren't going to amend this to put your other bill back in here or any of that. Will you resist other efforts to do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, the only, I think the reason you're asking me this is because Representative Wilkin just asked if I'd work with him on this. Frankly, the only place that I will tell you right now that I would be interested in discussing it, unless the Pharmacists Association, the involved parties, came forward and said there's a change that we think we need, and I would assume they'd be going to both sides of the aisle to discuss that change, would be in line 2.9. And this is just the lawyer in me, because I think that last sentence, or the last part of the sentence that starts with "and the pharmacist's employer can," I would work with Representative Wilkin and anyone else to make that language a little bit better. It seems to me that we want to make sure there's no confusion. This is simply intended to balance a couple of competing interests and to make sure that a patient has access to legally prescribed medication. So in a roundabout way, I've just told you I will not go back and push the bill that I originally introduced as I would like, but I also cannot commit to you that there's under no circumstance would we ever as a body on both sides of the aisle discuss making some minor modifications. But the bill as drafted and its intent would not change.
Very good. Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative?
Just one thing as a technical comment about the drafting of it. I think on line 124 and 127 that those should be semicolons and not periods. Then I have a question. And maybe staff can just...
Okay.
So those are sub-points, and then there's an or later on the page 2.
And then there's a what, Mr. Chairman?
Those are clauses in a section, and they're meant to be inclusive with the use of the word or on line 2.4. There's a semicolon that precedes the word or on line 2.4, which I think would be the properly used at the end of those 1.24 and 1.27, so...
Mr. Chairman, I
Representative Emmer.
I recognize Representative Abler's semicolon amendment, and I'm sure the reviser's office or whoever addresses it will take care of that.
Yeah, it's minor. But I mean, does otherwise make those statements in that or? Is there not, there's some protection in the or that people
yes.
want. But I have two questions. Representative Emmer and, or whoever, do you foresee an issue with employers of a pharmacist who's going to choose to exercise his conscience clause? Is there any protection for him or her if they want to do this and the employer doesn't want to hire them because of this? Is that something else for another bill for next year that we'll have to look at?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, my understanding is the way this would work is you would apply for a job as a pharmacist. You would be hired, and then at some point, if you have some objection to a specific drug or a class of drugs, you would make that objection known to the employer in writing. As it's been explained to me by the Pharmacists Association and others in support of this legislation, and they're certainly welcome to come up and confirm this, the employer would not be excluding pharmacists the hiring process based on what they might or might not sell. This is something that they would make known after they're employed.
And I'm not sure we can even be sure about that, but I'm just raising it as a question. I bet we'll be hearing about that in the future. I don't know. One more question, Mr. Chair. And
Representative Abel,
on the pharmacist end, does this create, I mean, some of the rural pharmacies in particular are just having a hard time staying open. Is this going to create a duty for them to stock more things, to do more work than they have to do now, even not counting the conscience part, just in the normal stuff they don't ever intend to sell? Now they have to find they didn't have to find stuff before, now they have to actually go to the work of finding some unusual drug that they don't carry that they wouldn't have helped the person find before. Is that going to be any issue for them?
I think if you take a look at line 2.2, it says make a reasonable effort, and there were questions earlier, what does that mean? I suspect that reasonable effort, and I don't suspect, I know that it's drafted in that manner so that someone can tell them, you can try this pharmacy down the street, you can go here, and in this day and age, and I apologize for not recognizing the chair, Representative Abler, in this day and age, with the internet, with all the different communication available, I don't envision that that's going to be a problem. The real issue is making sure that there's some method for access.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Ms. Benson, thank you for your testimony.
Representative Houston also had
to. I mean, if we're done with testimony, I just wanted to, I think this is a very difficult issue that we're grappling with here, but I also think that this bill, in its general contours and specifics, really strikes a balance on some very difficult competing interests, and so I think it makes sense for us to go forward with it.
Very good. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodman.
I did have an amendment in here. I didn't know if you were going to bring that up.
Well, I've seen it. Would you like to bring it up?
Actually, no, I will withdraw this amendment, but I do want to state again that I am very concerned about the words reasonable effort and reasonable accommodation in the bill, and hoping that that won't give too wide and broad of ways out of prescribing, of filling doctor prescribed medications.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Goodman. Any further discussion? Hearing none, Representative Emmer renews his motion that House File 3032, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion passes. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Okay. Next item on the calendar, on the agenda, is an informational walkthrough from a bill from Representative Bradley. Okay. Actually, the bill number is 3144. The bill number next will be 3144.
About that
Yeah. Okay. Representative Bradley?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm mindful of time. I believe that I may be the star attraction on the House floor because I think I've got a bill up there today, so I'm particularly mindful of the need. I mean, session starts at noon, so this is an information hearing. I think that gives us some prerogatives in terms of ending the meeting so that we can all be over there on time. Let me just give a kind of a brief background here and then turn it over for testimony. Anybody who travels the state and looks at the services for elderly Minnesotans knows that the landscape is changing. It's changing, I think, because consumers are driving the marketplace. And if you look around, you see the emergence of alternatives. And particularly, you see the emergence in the whole range, everything from people being able to stay in their homes longer with a variety of services, all the way to hospital and several options in between. One of those options in between is something that certainly the marketplace is seeing more and more of. It's the phenomenon called assisted living. And we have seen more and more of that. But what's been sort of missing really is a really solid statutory framework of what assisted living constitutes, what the framework of requirements are on those that provide it, what are some of the minimums, how do you define it, how do you hold accountable, and then also the question begged is sort of how you assure quality. Those of you who know me and remember Region 10 Quality Assurance know that I'm a big proponent of consumer-centered quality, and in particular in this area, I've been anxious to sort of encourage the stakeholders to take control of the issue before we lose control. And before an incident or two, it turns this whole world of assisted living into another nightmare that this committee has seen in the kind of the survey process for nursing homes. That we have an opportunity now, while we're still in control, to statutorily make these kinds of definitions. Now, that's the backdrop, and I want to do a tip of the hat to a group of stakeholders who are the full cross-section as far as how in the world you ever come to a conclusion that there is consensus on. Not an easy task in this field where there certainly are a variety, and I tip my hat to the group. We have two representatives of that, but as you, I think you have a handout as part of 2006 legislative proposal for assisted living. You'll notice at the top that that it does identify a number of additional stakeholders. I think what I'd like to do in the short time that we have is turn it over to the testifiers. The intention this morning would be to do nothing more than just sort of give you the framework. My encouragement to members would be to take this this bill, the description, home with you, and share it with some of the people in your areas. I think it's valuable, and it's one of the values that we can have here, really, is just to even go further. Even though there have been a wide variety of stakeholders, I know I've already heard from at least one, and there are a couple of areas where I have an interesting concern. I think it would be in our own best interest if we take this opportunity between now, having heard a description of the bill, and when it comes back for our action, to share it with some of our own constituents and our own provider groups. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you to the committee, and I would like to turn it over. Ms. Freeman, whichever you'd like to start. Are you going to start?
All right. Thank you, Representative Bradley, Mr. Chairman, and members. My name is Iris Freeman, and I am speaking on behalf of the Alzheimer's Association. As Representative Bradley indicated, we will quickly provide some background and history on the bill, begin to demonstrate its need, begin to show that we've taken a very sound approach and a thoughtful approach, and as you can see, among us, begin to display the broad support among those organizations most directly affected. It is partially my responsibility for you to get to session without spraining an ankle, so I shall not do a lecture on the importance of the public policy issue of long-term care of the elderly. I can say that assisted living is an increasingly important segment of long-term care. Just one fact. In 1996, when the Housing with Services Law was passed, there were roughly 150 Housing with Services establishments. Today, there are 1,050. 10 years later, 150 to 1,050, and this trend will continue. There are pressures both from consumers and their families and legislators to expand community care, to serve people with significant daily needs outside of traditional nursing homes and to assure that people could age in place. That's a familiar term. And yet, while we've seen this steep growth in the number of providers, there's no uniform definition in Minnesota or even a widely held understanding of what assisted living means. It's a very familiar term. People say, she's failing, we're going to have to look at assisted living. But if you ask any number of doctors, any number of daughters-in-law, any number of legislators, any number of your neighbors, well, what's assisted living? You will get that number of different answers. We have begun to grapple with exactly what kind of assistance should we be talking about. Because places that call themselves assisted living vary in price and size and accommodations and service and staffing. Some have mixed specialties, some have one, and this infinite variety has caused confusion in the marketplace, confusion that benefits neither the providers nor the consumers. Providers have a number of ways that John has recited, and other providers have recited ways that the confusion hurts them. Consumers certainly are faced with a dizzying array at a time when they're really trying to make the best choice for a loved one. And besides that consumer confusion, there have been incidents in which quality and unmet expectations have also been part of the story and part of what we hear at AARP and the Alzheimer's Association, at the Elder Care Rights Alliance, and the Ombudsman. Minnesota is by no means alone in this. And just a few years ago, at the federal level, the U.S. Special Committee on Aging held hearings to talk about federal oversight of assisted living. It didn't happen. There are 2003 recommendations, much more extensive than this. The recommendations that were brought by the national counterparts of our stakeholder organizations actually went a bit further. But what they said, what the committee said was, all right, now send this out to the states. Let's see what states can do. States define assisted living. And so that was our charge, and if Representative Bradley might call this the Federal Rules Avoidance Act, we can add it to the title of the bill. Indeed, that special committee is looking for our action and looking at other states as well and saying, remember, this is a legitimate federal concern because Medicaid waivers are used in assisted living, federal tax incentives to purchase long-term care insurance affect assisted living. Go, therefore, states, and do a good job. Well, the big question that faced all of us, and there were a lot of us, was, well, how do we write and agree on standards that are clear enough to make a difference to consumers and yet elastic enough to allow varied and unique and special approaches to programming? Well, you know, you can't answer big questions with small participation. And so I do want to acknowledge care providers in MAHA for getting the ball rolling, for including the Home Health Association and hospice, the Nurses Association, and the Board of Licensing for Nurses, including all of the seniors organizations that I mentioned just a moment ago, including representatives from the counties and the state agencies and the Ombudsman. Our meetings have spanned a period from September 9th of 2004 until now. We had initially hoped to have a bill prepared for the 2005 session. That was ambitious, but we shared our diverse experiences. We debated among ourselves rather than before all of you. We challenged ourselves to keep at it because it is an important and growing public policy issue, and we truly believe this is the time to take action. And so with that, I turn it over to my colleague.
Mr. Lips, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Lips. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, and also as the tip of the iceberg, as we've been saying, also on behalf of the variety of other stakeholders who participated in our process. It's my job. I'll take just 4 to 5 minutes, Mr. Chairman, to walk you through the two-page handout that you have, which describes the main components of the bill. I want to emphasize at the beginning, before we enumerate these requirements, that the approach we've taken in the bill is one that does not require any individual provider to comply with any of these requirements.
It's not a completely free choice in the sense that if a provider does not comply with this list of things, then it could not market itself to the world as assisted living. But if it cannot or does not choose to comply with one of these requirements, it will be able to continue its business model just the way it is today, but under a different title. And I also want to emphasize that this will not require consumers to buy any particular package of services. They will be free to take or leave the services as they need to, as they have the right to do under our state law, and indeed to choose what providers, what home care providers, should deliver the services that they need. So in brief, our bill states that if an organization markets itself as assisted living, it has to meet the series of requirements that are laid out in this document. I'll begin with item 2, which is that a certain minimum level of health-related services should be available. What's not stated here, but which is in the bill, is that these services would be delivered under a licensed, under a home care license as bestowed by the Department of Health. So an RN assessment would be offered to all assisted living clients that is consistent with current law, but we also have provision in the bill which states that the housing provider in our housing with services setting would make all prospective clients aware of the ability to have an assessment before they move in, and that would be an advance which we think would help to achieve a good fit between providers and consumers, that there would be supervision of unlicensed staff by licensed nurses, as also reflects current law, and that there would be available assistance with self-admin of medications or administration of medications. This is an advance from our current system in which an organization could market itself to seniors as assisted living without making any health-related services available whatsoever. Item 3 states that the provider would offer to provide or make available assistance with 3 out of the 7 listed activities of daily living. Item 4 is a very important element of the bill and one that has generated conversation already. It has to do with the provider being aware of and responding to health and safety needs of the clients. One thing that's not listed here as an oversight on my part is, in addition to having a response system, the provider will also affirmatively check on the status of its residents once a day. But in addition, that the provider will have a system by which the client can reach out for help with health and safety needs 24 hours a day, 7 days per week, and that the provider would have a response system that consisted of an individual who is awake and on-site within our definition of that, which I'll return to in just a second, and which has certain functional capacities that are described in your summary. We might have taken an approach of identifying a training requirement, for example, of everybody that works in an assisted living place, but we've decided not to do that. Instead, we've simply identified, borrowing language from a Department of Human Services bulletin, which exists, that administers the waiver program, we've outlined the functional capacity that the individual should have. What we mean by awake and on-site, with respect to on-site, we mean that the individual should either be in the same building where the person resides or in an attached building. An example would be that there is an assisted living establishment attached to a nursing home, or on the same contiguous campus, and that reflects an existing business model where multiple buildings, maybe with a smaller number of units in each, are contained within the same grounds. So an awake on-site staff person, 24 hours a day, available to respond to health and safety needs. Next, supportive services that they would offer to provide or make available, 2 meals per day. There's no specificity in our bill about what those meals would be. They do not have to be group dining, for example. At least weekly housekeeping and laundry service, and some reasonable assistance to arrange transportation for the client, to arrange for the client to access community services, social services, and other resources that the provider has chosen not to make available directly, and some periodic opportunities for socialization. So what's here are indeed the general category of supportive services, but also the notion that individuals residing in assisted living should maintain their community integration to the maximum extent possible. Item 6, a consumer information guide. This doesn't exist today, but we've included in our bill a request that the health department should charge those of us that crafted this proposal with creation of a uniform format by which assisted living providers would deliver information about themselves to consumers and enable consumers to compare assisted living one against another more easily than they can do today. In the area of accountability for services, we have a requirement here that requires, that states if an individual is having some difficulty with a home care service, and if they complain about that issue or raise it with somebody who is a member of the housing establishment's staff, that the housing establishment should do what it can to assist in resolution of that issue. This bullet point reflects that we have a separation of housing from services in Minnesota. It's a unique system, one that by and large has worked well, but not entirely without problems. And there are instances when the consumer or the client doesn't appreciate the difference between the housing provider and the home care provider, and this is intended to address that in part. The enforcement and oversight mechanism will be the same as it exists in current law with respect to housing with services establishments and licensed home care agencies. We can go into this in more detail later, and indeed we're having some discussion with the Department of Health about how this will be implemented. On the housing side, if a housing provider isn't doing something that the law requires it to do, the department has a variety of referral and injunctive relief-related enforcement mechanisms, and for licensed home care agencies, they have survey and correction order and fining authority with respect to those. So what we have done is to mirror those enforcement mechanisms that exist currently into our proposal. And finally, if a housing provider or a home care provider terminates their relationship or agreement with the client, they will provide a specified form of notice that identifies some information about the client's legal rights and information about how they can connect with additional services on the home care side. So with that, I've taken too much time. Mr. Chairman, that's an overview of the bill, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I will say, Representative Bradley, I've talked to several providers in my district, and not only do they tell me that they approve of this approach, they've actually felt as they were part of the solution, that they were their thoughts and ideas were listened to. So I believe everybody's going to get a gold star for working and playing well with others here, so that's very good.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you're absolutely right. A gold star is in order. I think if you just look at the substance of this, it's a really remarkable piece of work. There are a couple of issues. One of them is whether or not there's a cost, and that's part of what's being worked with the health department. I would expect it to come back to this committee for our action within the next couple of weeks. I do think this will give us the time for those who do want to talk to some of your additional providers and for some of these items that we're trying to work through. But I do want to also congratulate our presenters this morning. I think you did an incredible job.
Representative Huntley has a question.
Well, we don't have any time, but I'd be very interested. I know you're meeting with me tomorrow, I think, or the next day, in the details of the regulation of these. You know, what I'm not quite sure actually what a registered housing with services establishment is, and your second bullet point one. Would that exclude an institution that has just apartments for seniors? And you go down the hall, it moves into assisted living, and further on down the hall, it's a nursing home. It seems to me that at least what's on this sheet would exclude them from saying they're assisted living.
Mr. Chairman and Representative,
Ms. Freeman, please.
We surely will do it tomorrow, but in fact, an organization that provides multiple services within a building or a campus would simply need to label each one accurately.
Very good. Anything further, Representative Bradley?
Not today.
Very good. Any other business? Seeing none, meeting adjourned.